She can't, the basin.
We do not have a quorum, but we're
Going to start the testimony, and the first bill up is House File 328, Representative Aaron Murphy. And we don't have to make a motion yet because we don't have a quorum. So why don't you just present the bill? There's at least one person signed up to talk.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I am here today to talk to you about House File 328, which is the legislation that is intended to make original birth certificates more available to people in Minnesota. And I'm really here just to talk with you about the fiscal note today, if you'd like. That's what I'd like to do. But I have to get a copy of it. Mr. Chair and members, I am wondering if I could invite Mr. Golden from the Department of Health to join me to talk a little bit about the fiscal note. There is no fiscal impact to this legislation. There is a fee charge for the birth certificate, and it covers the cost of this. But Mr. Golden is more expert than I, and we talked briefly before this that he might be able to come up and answer a couple of questions, and I thought maybe I'd just ask him to come up and talk briefly.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Golden. I'm the director of the Division of Health Policy at the Department of Health. I guess I'd be more than willing to answer any questions. What we did with the fiscal note is this is part of birth records. Birth records is a fee system. So what we have done is we have looked at what some other states have had as their experience when their law has changed, where these records weren't available to where they were available. We have tried to use that to get some estimates on the number that we would expect. Our expectation is that there is usually a very high volume initially in the very first month, and then it starts to tail off to a steady stream. What we have here as a fee is essentially the fee that is the same fee for a regular certified birth certificate, which is $13, plus a $5 search charge. These particular types of records require us to do a search of the affidavits to try to understand if there's an affidavit of disclosure or non-disclosure, and then follow those requirements. What we have here is the number that we estimate, and ultimately the net impact is essentially zero. And it balances over time because the fees balance out with the costs associated with retrieving and distributing these records to people who request them.
Okay, any questions for Dr. Golden? Seeing none, so there's no real fiscal impact to the general fund in this bill.
Mr. Chair, there is not. This is a program that is all fee-based. It's all out of the state government special revenue. This is just very consistent with the fee structure that we currently have there. It brings fees into the state government special revenue, and then we would appropriate them out for staff to carry out these activities.
Representative Kiffmeyer's, when we start the meeting, will have an amendment if you'd like to talk about it while people are wandering in here.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, do I?
Yeah, just you can do it from right there, or you can go sit up in front, whatever you choose.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll just do it from here, if you like. The amendment that I have prepared is in concert with adoption agencies and advocates, as well as the Minnesota Department of Health as well. And the language of this amendment to House File 328 is mainly that at the point of actually having a birth record being provided, that at that same point, information, written information about counseling and support services the commissioner would work with the adoption agencies and adoption advocates to put together information so that at the point they get the birth record, they are fully informed as to any services provided, any other options that are there or available to make the whole process go better. So I felt this was a valuable addition, and I've also discussed this with the author as well, and is acceptable to it. So that is my amendment.
Okay. We're too short, so. Well, we can't worry about it. We haven't brought it up yet. Okay, yeah, there is a witness, I think, Karen Wiswell. See here. Well, we have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order. And Representative Murphy moves to recommend it to be passed and laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. So that's been moved. Why don't we deal with the Kiffmeyer Amendment, which my understanding is not controversial. Everybody supports it. Any discussion of the Kiffmeyer Amendment?
Can we restate
it? Basically, it requires that when somebody gets the birth certificate, they have to be informed of all the protections that could be there.
Mr. Chair.
You're Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're in a finance committee now, but I've worked with Representative Kiffmeyer on this amendment, and I'm happy to accept it on the bill.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the Kiffmeyer Amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So the amendment is adopted, and okay, is there a Karen Wiswell here? I guess not, so
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holberg.
I have her testimony, if I could read it into the record. I know I talked about 20 minutes ago and she was on her way here, but
okay. Go ahead, Representative Holberg.
All right, thank you. My name is Karen Wiswell, and I am here today to ask you not to support the bill to unseal adoption records for adoptions that occurred prior to 1977, House File Number 328, nor to include it in the omnibus bill. I am here today because a daughter never forgets. My mother was a victim of a breach of confidentiality through an adoption agency. This breach resulted in multiple hospitalizations for mental and emotional breakdown, and I believe was a strong contributing factor, if not the direct cause, of the development of the cancer that killed her 3.5 years after the breach occurred. You may see happy, cheerful reunions with of adoptees with their birth mothers, but I am here to testify. The disclosure also has a dark side. I am also here to represent the thousands of birth mothers who can't be here because of the driving need to preserve their anonymity. As you know, in 1977, laws relating to new adoptions were changed to allow disclosure of personal information of birth parents. Prior to 1977, adoption standards guaranteed anonymity for birth parents. 30 years ago, in the summer of 1979, my mother's life and our family's life was turned upside down when she received a phone call from a daughter she had given up for adoption prior to getting married. 5 minutes later, that daughter was on her front doorstep with a friend who was a law student and involved with a lobbying group who was working to unseal adoption records. They had browbeaten a caseworker at the adoption agency into disclosure, reasoning at the time that a law to unseal was going to be passed anyway. Not only did they show up with 5 minutes' notice on the front doorstep, they told my mother that they knew of her two other daughters, including me, from her subsequent marriage, where we all lived and worked, and what our husbands' names and occupations were, and how many children we had had, etc. Remember, this was the era prior to the existence of today's computer technology and Google searches. My mother asked her daughter if she wanted a relationship with her, and her reply was, "No, I already have a mother," meaning her adopted mother. But she was interested in information related to healthcare background. So my mother shared her own father was a diabetic and had died of heart failure in his late 70s. There was no history of cancer or other disease in the family. As quickly as the daughter blew into my mother's world, she blew out of it. My mother, however, knew her privacy had been violated. She was a girl from a farming community, very small town, and very Catholic, where people care about what neighbors think. Her pregnancy had been concealed. Most members of her family had no idea. She lived in a home for unwed mothers until the child was born, then adopted the baby through a Minnesota adoption agency. Although abortion was not yet legal, it's common knowledge that it was available. She chose life for her child, and she trusted the agency and the law that her privacy would be preserved. It was not preserved. She was never given the option of deciding if she wanted contact with the now adult child she had given up for adoption, as allowed by current law. She was forced into disclosure. Her privacy had been violated aggressively. Thus began a cascade of events that included multiple hospitalizations for mental and emotional breakdown, including her ultimate belief that the FBI was following her. Her privacy had been so violated that her state of mental breakdown, she believed her entire life had been laid out for public view. I work for a large Minnesota company. I have a healthcare background, and in the course of my work, I have had the privilege of working with world-renowned physicians and researchers in the area of human immunology. Many of them will tell you that severe emotional trauma can contribute to severe depression of the human immune system, making one vulnerable to a host of disease states. Although I cannot present conclusive clinical research to you today, I will always believe that this event caused, or at least was a major contributor to the development of the cancer that was diagnosed the following year, killing my mother 2.5 years later. In 1997, I was contacted directly at work by the adoptee, wanted to know if I wanted to make contact. I declined. Although she stated in her meeting with my mother that she already had an adoptive mother, I had lost mine. Several years ago, my husband and I rented out a property to a tenant. His background check was fine, but during the 2 years we rented to him, he started his own business as a drug dealer. When he was arrested, he moved to a new home, prison. He left a huge mess behind, and we cleaned up. When he was released from prison, I inquired about how I could find him to attempt to recover some of the expenses incurred from the cleanup. I was told he was entitled to his privacy. I could get no information to locate him. The dope dealer had a right to privacy. In my experience working in healthcare, I have worked in emergency room personnel who treat trauma patients who are squirting large volumes of blood upon admission. They treat patients without knowing HIV status because the patients are entitled to privacy. What about privacy for birth mothers? These days, unwed mothers are encouraged to finish school, thus some schools have daycare centers in the schools to care for babies born out of wedlock. Mothers, many may believe they are no more social taboos regarding unwed pregnancy, but that is not the belief held by 100% of the population. Many birth mothers who want their privacy preserved still live in a world where unwed pregnancy is shameful. Their belief system is such that unwed pregnancy is a social and cultural taboo. If you think this is inconsequential, ask yourself, why did Bill Clinton lie to a grand jury about the Lewinsky affair? It was a lie to the grand jury that led to his impeachment. Why Senator Larry Craig pled guilty to a charge of disorderly conduct after the incident in the men's room in the Minneapolis airport? He wanted the incident to go away. Why young single girls still take newborns and put them in dumpsters? Why some gay and lesbian kids commit suicide rather than coming out to their families? It's because of fear of disclosure, fear of being outed, fear of being shamed. We have much cultural diversity in the U.S. and in the state of Minnesota. We observe Black History Month. We celebrate Kwanzaa and Ramadan and among holidays. We allow women to wear veils in the workplace, sometimes in conflict with OSHA requirements, because we do not want to offend the culture. We ask physicians to become culturally competent and become educated on varying religious beliefs of their culturally diverse patient population. Our voicemail systems ask callers to press 1 for English, 2 for Spanish. We are asked to respect and honor many cultures, and at the very least, we seek not to offend. Why can't we honor the cultures and belief systems of our mothers and grandmothers? Ask yourself, what is the most shameful thing you have ever done? Would you want that published in a newspaper and known to your family? I understand the adoptive child's need to know about healthcare information. There are many methods to provide this information to the child and still preserve the biological parent's privacy. There are already a number of adoption services that engage in this service. The government should administer a program of awareness via public service announcements or many other avenues to broadcast the existence of these services to allow birth parents to provide the healthcare information while still preserving their privacy. Please do not support passage of the bill to unseal adoption records. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Holzer? Seeing none, Representative Murphy renews her motion that House File 328, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. So the bill is laid over. Next, we have Representative Hosh with House File 1890. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 1890 has actually two different sections relating to the nursing home moratorium exception. The first section simply extends currently...
We have to move the bill first. So, Representative Hosh moves House File 1890 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill.
That would be my motion, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Potts, I've also been told there's a technical amendment to your bill that's being recommended on line 2.1. The Commissioner of Health should be the Commissioner of Human Services on line 2.1.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would move to add end human services after health on line 2.1.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Potts, it should just be Commissioner of Human Services, okay. No reference to health.
Okay, so the bill is amended, but this section of the bill is not going to stay around very long. So the it's been moved that where it says Commissioner of Health should be changed to Commissioner of Human Services. Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, there's two separate sections to this bill, mainly. The first section simply extends currently approved exceptions to the moratorium for nursing homes. Due to some of the economic conditions and difficulty of credit, it would make sense to be able to allow these projects that have gained approval to be extended for another 18 months so they can continue their projects without being penalized for it. This could actually save us some money in this current biennium, so I think that's a good thing that the committee could consider. Section 2, Mr. Chair and members, gives an appropriation of $3 million for the nursing home moratorium exception, and this money can actually leverage additional dollars up to the tune of $185 million of projects for our nursing homes throughout the state of Minnesota. I don't need to tell you about the economic stresses that we have on our state budget, so the committee can do what they wish with Section 2, but I think it's important to show what the $3 million state investment can leverage when it comes to projects and to jobs. With that said, Mr. Chair, I don't have a whole lot more explanation on the bill. I'm not sure if there's any testifiers that... We do have one testifier.
2, Mr. Chair.
So if you welcome to the committee, and if you would state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Tom Pollack, the administrator at Park River Estates Care Center in Coon Rapids, a 99-bed skilled facility. I wanted to address the extension of the moratorium approval process. Under the current law, projects approved under the moratorium exception process have 18 months to begin construction. The long-term care imperative is proposing to provide an extension of approval by an additional 18 months for projects approved under the moratorium exception process between July 2007 and June of 2009. The extension is temporary and only applies to projects approved under previously approved appropriations. Most critical are those facilities that received approval for projects in January of 2008. The approval for these projects will expire by July of this year. Due to the failure of the economy and credit markets late last year, some have run into difficulty in securing affordable financing to begin their projects. An 18-month extension of approval will provide those facilities that are experiencing difficulty additional time to start their projects. The Department of Health and Department of Human Services has indicated that there's no negative fiscal impact of this provision. And I did want to point out that my specific facility was approved. We would add on a 14-bed rehab unit, increase our private rooms from 15 to 39, which is exactly what the consumer wants. Unfortunately, the banks are not willing to loan money right now, which is no surprise to many people. And yet it's a project that we want to move forward, but come July 1st, our appropriation would expire.
Okay, questions for Mr. Pollack? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the question I have for you, and you certainly made the case for the economy and the situation and for the delay and needing to do that. Usually, though, the question of some of these funding issues from banks is in regards to the ability to pay it back. You would think with items like this where you have state backing and so on and so forth, that you should be able to qualify, and because there'd be no question of your ability to pay this. So what's the reason why they would delay it? I mean, is it just a timing issue, pure economy, or what's their question here? It just seems a little bit odd on something that has this kind of tie-in to be a question. Just curious.
Mr. Pollack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kiffmeyer. It is very odd. Projects in the past have flown through the process. The facility is family-owned. It's been family-owned since 66. Good reputation with the banks. Our credit rating is excellent. And so now they're asking for personal... for all the owners to personally sign that they're going to back it, and yet that they're just frustrated as I am.
Mm-hmm. So. I could just comment that this is a huge problem, at least all over the state of Minnesota, whether you're talking about nursing homes or hospitals. Virtually every hospital building project that was about to start has been stopped because there's no financing available. Representative House was in here a couple of weeks ago with a hospital bonding bill. That hospital had intended to have been built by a hospital chain. They can't borrow the money. I do know that the, I think it's the SMDC Benedictine. Well, anyway, they had to separate their nursing home division from their hospital division because of the interaction of the loans. And we are in a national crisis, and it's having the effect that we see here today. Is there another person who wants to testify?
No, Mr. Chair. There's no other testifiers. If if the committee wishes so.
Representative Hosh, I would move that we remove sections 2 and sections 3.
Mr. Chair, I understand the motion. You know, I would hope that if somehow we did run into some unforeseen dollars that this could be considered in the future, because it does leverage a significant amount of activity within the construction and jobs area. But I understand the need for the removal.
Well, I can tell you in the omnibus bill we'll be doing everything we can to maximize any federal participation we can get. So, all those in favor of the motion to remove sections 2 and 3, signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. 2 and 3 are gone, Representative Hosh renews his motion that House File 1890 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. And next we have a presentation from, well, why don't we do the minutes first, from the March 19th meeting. Representative Fritz moves that we approve the March 19th minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? So the minutes are adopted, and now we have from the Department of Human Services a overview of the governor's GAMC proposal, the disproportionate share hospital payments, and the Merck funding. And the GAMC is relatively straightforward, I think, but the certainly the dish payments and Merck are some of the more complex things. The only thing we left off our list here is intergovernmental transfers, which would probably take a whole hour by itself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg, Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare, Department of Human Services, and we're here to answer any questions you may have about that page. Now, that is the revised page 161. I'm not sure if you have that in front of you still or not. One thing that I understand that you would like to hear more about is our care coordination approach to this page.
Yes.
And Dr. Jeff Schiff will be coming up to present that at this point.
Dr. Schiff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Schiff. I'm the Medical Director of the Department of Human Services, and we were asked to put together a care coordination structure for patients who would be eligible for this modified GAMC program. As I'm sure you know, this modified GAMC program does not include directly include hospitalization, but includes an uncompensated care pool through a dish for patients who are in this program. The care coordination aspect of this was really an outgrowth of the work that has been done through the 2007 and 2008 legislative sessions to emphasize the aspects of care coordination to decrease hospitalization, unnecessary hospitalization, and ER use. The proposal that's being put forward is that patients who are eligible in this GAMC benefit would have a care coordination that is primary care based, that is paid on a per participant basis to these primary care clinics in order to hopefully obviate the need for and unnecessary hospitalization and ER. The criteria, this is actually a, as we propose it, a slimmed down version of what we're proposing and putting into place for the PCC program, the 2007 fee-for-service legislation, and the 2008 healthcare home legislation. And a few things to say, the per the per-person payments as we envision them would be made at two different levels, one for a basic level and one for patients who are more complex. So it would be made to clinics that would attest to providing the services for care coordination, and they would be paid after the an interval of time when after the service has been provided. I'd be happy to take questions.
Dr. Schiff, some of this population, first of all, doesn't live in the Twin Cities.
Correct.
And they drive down here or they go to their own hospital. Are you anticipating that we will have primary care clinics take care of these folks all over the state or in certain areas?
We anticipate that primary care clinics, wherever they are eligible to attest to providing the service and be eligible for payment.
And a lot of these folks, the first time we see them is when they show up in a hospital and they're not used to getting primary care. How do you plan to deal with that?
I think that's Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and we understand that a lot of these folks do show up for hospitalization first. We would expect that if folks are in this program, there would be some greater motivation for the primary care clinics to actually manage these patients prospectively. And one of the things we realize that care coordination would require in this population will be greater ability to outreach to these individuals rather than waiting for them to more passively arrive in the clinic. I will say that this is sort of putting a concept that we believe strongly in and putting it into use for a specific population, and I don't think we know for sure how we'll alter the care of these patients. We're anticipating that having the primary care clinics available will alter their first point of contact.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Dr. Schiff. In follow-up to Representative Huntley's question, do you think it would be, is it sort of department's view that maybe we would know who the people are who would be disenrolled from JMC and we would try to match them up with primary care clinics or do some outreach to these individuals so there was a match made? Have you thought that part through, or is it just going to be more sort of random?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, maybe some of the enrollment people could speak more to this, but I think it would be likely as these patients who would only be paid for care coordination if they remain enrolled in this service that the primary care clinics would have a motivation to outreach to them prospectively.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. And Dr. Schiff, could you just talk through the payment part for me one more time? When we heard about this in the governor's budget proposal last week, it's clear that it was a fee-for-service payment. So I'm just wondering if you could, since you've been working on this payment stuff, if you could sort of walk us Correct. Through how this Okay. would work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the way in which we have developed a payment structure for PCC, and I want to be clear, this is not the same program as that, because in the two other medical home proposals we've worked through, we realized that we're working hard to get a robust capacity up to speed, and what this is calling for is perhaps a quicker response by the provider community. But in all of these proposals, what are there's actually, I would say there are three components to the payment structure. The first is to identify clinics who are capable of providing the service, so that a clinic first has to attest in this particular situation to be able to provide services to do care coordination and outreach to these patients. The second thing is to develop then categories of patients to be paid, and our feeling about the population that's served in GAMC is that this population is, by definition, a complex set of patients, both because of their social history circumstances and also because of their medical diagnoses. So our proposal as far as payment really in this is to propose a very simple two-step payment methodology, one for patients who are have a basic level of care coordination need, and then a second for those who have a higher level of medical and or mental health complexity that we haven't, quite honestly, we haven't really done the fine work on separating that out yet. And then the third is about the payment methodology for this, and or the amount. And in our work that we've done before, we have started out in our original budget page in the 2007 legislation with an average of $600 per member per month to do care coordination, with the idea that that money would save significant money downstream. That was the money, that was the number we used for the fee-for-service population in our Medicaid population, not specifically this group. We believe that in order to do this adequately in this amount of care coordination, we need to offer to clinics about that amount of money to start as a baseline for these patients, with it possibly going up for more complex patients.
Representative.
So, how does per member per month? I must have missed something.
Okay.
Fit in with a fee for service kind of.
Sorry. Representative Huntley and Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I suppose when we applied and received approval from CMS around per member per month, they were very clear, not for this population, but for the other population, we had to link this to an interval of time. So the average amount that we're proposing for the baseline for this is $50 per member per month.
But Mr. Chair, that's still not. I must be missing something, because I thought we're doing this on a fee for service basis. So how does a per member per month fit with the fee for service? That seems like two different concepts to me.
Okay,
Dr. Schiff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, the way in which we have built this model is that a clinic is eligible to receive a payment for this care over an interval of time as a service they provide. So if the billing interval, which it will be for PCC, is 6 months, they will receive on average $50 per month after they provide this care coordination service for a total of 6 months. So it's billed as a service they provide. You're still not, that makes it, it's billed as a service that's provided by the clinic over an interval of time.
Mr. Chair, so they're getting you're paying them on a kind of per member per month, but not through a managed care plan. That's the thing that I'm missing here.
No.
Okay.
Not through a managed care plan.
I got it. Sorry.
Okay.
We can't. Not with the other witness when you get back to him.
But Dr. Schiff, would they also then bill for other services, like every time there's an office visit or whatnot?
Mr. Chair, they would have the ability to bill for other services as well.
And
Mr. Chair, maybe you've seen this. Do we have this kind of plan laid out for us anywhere? Are we going to have legislative language? Is that what it's going to look like? Or are we just going to turn this over to the discretion of the department to do?
We'll have to have language.
And Mr. Chair, do they think the language is going to be just saying we're going to develop this program and do it, or is there going to actually be language that lays out how all this works out in more detail than that?
This is Chairman, Member of the Committee, Shannon McMahon from the Department of Human Services. Representative Thiessen, in response to your question, yes, it is expected that there will be modifications to the existing governor's budget bill, which was heard in this committee last week, so that Representative Abler was the author of. And so this proposal, along with the other modifications that were presented last week, would be an amendment to that bill.
And Mr. Chair, the department knows that we have a policy deadline coming up here in like 3 days.
Mr. Chair and Representative Thiessen, we are aware of that, and I will certainly convey your concerns to our budget staff and to the Department of Finance, who's been working with us on this.
Because, Mr. Chair, this is not just a finance issue. This is a fundamental change in policy as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I would say that this is a movement towards the policy that we've been moving towards with the health care reform legislation, but accelerating it for this population to try to provide services that will enhance their care with limited resources.
Any other questions?
I'm sorry. Just on the whole, GAMC payment and how we're doing this, just can I get a little more clarification on what we're going to be paying for and the actual GAMC benefits? Like, my understanding is we're going to, for instance, not be covering ambulance service.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we can, in fact, leave you the list of services that will be included and not included. But what is included in the budget proposals of all outpatient services, such as physician visits, labs, diagnostic imaging, and ambulatory surgeries. Prescription drugs is included, non-inpatient mental health services are included, and care coordination that you just heard about is included. But it's not included, of course, inpatient services and emergency room visits will be a part of the uncompensated care pool. The other benefit that an earlier proposal the governor has made in terms of excluding dental, podiatry, chiropractic would not be included, as well as the rehab services. Transportation would not be included, and eyeglasses and hearing aids would not be included. We can detail this. In fact, of course, the legislation, the language that we'll have will detail this out.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, as part of that, are we going to get information on the local impacts of some of that stuff?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, are you referring to local impact?
Well, I would say the property tax impact, for instance, I'm saying all this knowing we're going to have to do some of these things, so I don't want to sound like, I just want to understand the proposal better. So, for instance, some ambulance services like Hennepin County are run through Hennepin County. And that's paid, so to the extent that they're not getting reimbursed anymore for these patients, for those ambulance rides, that'll be borne by Hennepin County taxpayers. So are you doing an analysis of those impacts as well as the state savings?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Osberg,
we can identify, I think we have identified on our page, what reduction in payment for inpatient services and ER and transportation is specifically. As to any conclusion around what would happen, certainly uncompensated care will increase. We've recognized that. We have said that. As to how that is dealt with locally is something that we cannot analyze at this point.
Well, Mr. Osberg, could you go over the proposal that related to the uncompensated care pool?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we're glad to talk about how that's going to be developed or managed. As we talked about last week, the uncompensated care pool will be a set amount, but it's not going to be first come, first serve. What will happen is that money will come out of the pool to the hospital based on volume and be proportional based on the volume incurred or provided by the hospital. So it would, and as
is that
said,
volume of uncompensated care, or
no? What would happen is that they will get a proportion of their payment based on what's available, based on the uncompensated care pool amount. So it would be a percentage of their payments that they would receive, and the balance would be certainly considered uncompensated care to them. What they don't receive in terms of payments would certainly be added to their uncompensated care obligation.
Commissioner Osberg, how much money is the governor proposing to be in this pool?
Mr. Chairman, it's $100 million for the next biennium and $115 million for the biennium after that.
again, this is what the next topic that we're going to cover is DISH. We want to make sure that there was enough money, comfortably enough money, in the uncompensated care pool for us to maximize the DISH payments from the federal government. And this does that. Now, the federal government is only recognizing inpatient expenditures in our fee-for-service side. That's in part why we're moving VAMC entirely over to the fee-for-service and out of managed care. But also the amount.
You said that the, well, I think we're getting into the DISH payment, so. But that is based on inpatient charges or outpatient?
Mr. Chairman, the DISH payment is based on inpatient expenditures through GAMC. That is the approval that we received the past 2 years, I think it was 2 years ago now, from CMS. To use our GAMC inpatient expenditures. And that's why, in part, that's what contributed to the amount being dedicated to the uncompensated care pool, is make sure we maximize that DISH payment on behalf of the hospital.
And currently that's based just on Hennepin County?
No, Mr. Chairman, it is not. We'll get into... that it's based on all of our expenditures. The state's expenditures in GAMC is based on all expenditures GAMC, not just the Hennepin County. There's a separate arrangement that referring to IGT arrangement that relates to certified public expenditures that Hennepin County incurs. And we can get into that, if you wish, of our next speaker, who is our expert on DISH and IGT and other aspects of...
Okay, well, why don't you bring up the next speaker, then?
I have Paul Olson from our Payment Policy Division come up and describe how the DISH payments work and how they're distributed as requested.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Olson, Department of Human Services Payment Policy Area. I'm going to give a quick overview of the disproportionate share hospital payments under current law. It's important to understand that before we start talking about the changes. There have been a number of changes over the years, though. Disproportionate share hospitals is DISH. That's what everybody called DISH. Originally, this was a federal Medicare term. It was then adopted over to Medicaid. We've had DISH payments under Medicaid for 25 years. It was called Disproportionate Population Adjustment. Now it's called DISH. The interesting aspect of DISH is it has become a payment policy of numerous moving parts. And in the last 15 years, there has been just immense evolution from just a reward system for high medical assistance utilization, as it was originally done, to a system in which various forms of financing have been arranged by the various states to attempt to maximize the amount of DISH payments. So it's taken on a life of its own, although it's not much different than most medical assistance payments. The original DISH payment is just an add-on for inpatient hospital services. This currently exists. It's what we call our fee-for-service DISH payment. As a hospital's medical assistance patient days to their total days, in other words, their book of business on MA, increases, they get an increasing reward from MA. Once you're at the mean, which is about 10 to 11%, if you're higher than that, you get that difference increased in your regular rates. So, for example, a hospital with 20% medical assistance utilization in patient days would have a 9% add-on to all their rates, all their medical assistance rates. So it rewarded higher medical assistance. Originally, I think 30 years ago, it was because it was supposed to be awarded to offset programs that paid very poorly on medical assistance. We also have evolved that into mean plus standard deviation to get more money, things like that. This originally started back in 92 when we were dealing with surcharges and things like that, and this became a mechanism to pay back for the surcharge. So it expanded a fair amount in those days.
Well, Mr. Olson, did the money that the government paid in excess go directly to the hospital that provided those services?
Yeah.
Or does it go to the state?
Under current law, well, this, the fee-for-service piece goes to the state. The GA, we'll talk about this later, but the GAMC DISH portion and the certified public expense portion also go to what's called that quarterly payment, although there is a reduction of 3 or 4%, depending on that fiscal year, that the state withholds. And that's in the law, based in the quarterly payment law, which took effect in October of 07. So most of the money trickles back except for that. This patient is the original payment, the fee-for-service add-on for doing a great book of business with MA, is all there. It's just like a normal add-on payment. That payment, the fee-for-service payment, goes from 1% to 59%. Children's hospitals have the highest levels of medical assistance business, and they get the highest levels of payment. So one of them gets a 59% add-on to their normal calculated medical assistance rates. What had happened then over the years was many states started getting quite innovative on how to get this money in. There were some southern states that developed these IGTs, intergovernmental transfers, and other things. There were no limits at the time. And they were building what we used to refer to as our RTCs out of cash, $800-900 million. And the federal government took note of that. CMS HICS at the time took great note of that. And what they did is they established a maximum amount that the federal government would share in DISH. That was the first step. That was then trended forward. It's been trended forward for about 5 years at 16%, and now it grows at just the CPI. For under the American Recovery Act, they gave an extra percent and a half, extra 2.5% in both fiscal year 9 and 10, but then it reverts to regular. It's worth about $4 million over those 2 years in total in federal share. It wasn't a vast amount of money.
And again, that goes to the hospitals.
It goes into our pool that we use, and the pool under current law is extinguished. The intent of all the laws, it's mechanized in the laws. All this stuff is in the statutes. It's mechanized within the statutes to the extent that, yes, it is all designed to use up every dime of that limit, and then all that money goes to hospitals or that trickle-off to the 3 or 4% that's currently in the quarterly payment law. So it does go back.
Could you go through that again?
Okay.
you said it was based on the MA book of business, and the money went directly to the hospital that provided the service.
I can skip to the end. There are three types of DISH payments. The first I described, that's the fee-for-service DISH. As the business goes up, it goes up. The second piece is called GAMC DISH. Currently, inpatient and outpatient hospital fee-for-service payments, we declare it as a DISH payment because for uncompensated care, GAMC is considered uncompensated care, half that money comes back to the state as a federal share. So it basically Medicaidizes the fee-for-service inpatient and outpatient GAMC. That then goes into a fund, and that's at 256B.199. In addition, to use up the rest of that limit, there's a third piece, and that's called the Certified Public Expenditure, and that's with Hennepin County. They're basically the only hospital that can participate under federal rules as being government-owned and able to tax all kinds of, there's all kinds of criteria, and other hospitals don't qualify. They do a Certified Public Expenditure. It's a very complex thing for them that was originally not anticipated through a cost reporting mechanism subject to audit by the Fed. A certified public expenditure, think of it this way, is essentially many times counties or hospitals or somebody will have an expenditure that's medical assistance, but it's not through our department. For example, the best one I think everybody uses is an eligibility worker who might be working in a hospital for the county, but that's a medical assistance person. So then they come to us and get their half the money for that person. That's essentially what a certified public expenditure is. In this case, certified public expenditures are for what is considered uncompensated care. And now, reverting to where I started, the limit they put on, the Fed's the second limit, other than that aggregate limit, to control Louisiana and these other states from doing this stuff was a thing that said your disproportionate share payments in a hospital cannot exceed your uncompensated care. A very stringent rule. Uncompensated care is defined as losses on MA, so basically what it costs them minus what we paid them, plus, and lucky for us, plus local government payments for services. So, for example, plus GAMC costs. But we don't have to, under federal law, declare that revenue. That is a huge favor for our state hospitals, for our hospitals in the state, not to go over that limit. So the limit is the uncompensated care within each facility. This has been on the books for many years. The Fed did not do anything about it. Many states are caught on audit. We were audited a number of times. We were ready for it. Now they have mandated that you have an independent certified audit of those costs. That's how serious they are. And it goes back to 2005. We're currently trying to get a contract out to get all this done for 05 and 06 by the end of this year and get a contract in place with an independent auditor. So it's gotten very serious to the Fed to control the DSH payments because of what has happened. The tie-in, what I'm saying, is that CPE from Hennepin County Medical Center that uses up the rest of the room in the aggregate limit is essentially that cost report for uncompensated care. It is essentially their limit of uncompensated care, and if they have any space left within that limit, they give it to us to get a federal share on. That's how the entire limit is used up. So that goes into the pool, too. So you've already paid the money out for anybody that does business with us, as in the fee-for-service rate. Then we put into this pool half of our GAMC inpatient and outpatient fee-for-service. Now we're going to put in that CPE for Hennepin County, and we're going to put it in up to the max. The latter two payments go into that pool, and then that goes out as what's called the quarterly payment. There is confusion on this, and I understand it. People like to fix that quarterly payment as a DSH payment. It is not a DSH payment. It's just a normal MA payment. But the pool is first reduced under law for this 3% rateable reduction. It's 3% of MA and Minnesota Care inpatient services. We keep that. We keep that as an offset to what we're spending on Minnesota Care and MA. The rest of that pool then goes into that quarterly payment, and it's $30 million a year. I mean, it's a substantial amount of money to the hospital. It's not tied to any claim or anything. So that's how the limit is used up. All this stuff, too, is subject to audit and subject to settlement, because we want to make sure that first payment for the 59% to a children's hospital goes out before the quarterly payment goes out. Or before the CPE and all those other payments go out. That's our most important payment. This system is so mechanized that because of that hospital-specific DSH limit, a children's hospital, I just use them as an example, they have a very hard time staying under that limit with a 59% DSH payment. Very hard time because they don't have any GAMC. Children's hospitals do not do GAMC business. So they don't have all the costs of a GAMC person to write off against their limit. So in law is written a thing called the hospital payment adjustment, which converts the name to hospitals to ensure that they get that money. The statutes are very clear. This money is to go out to those hospitals, everything but that 3-4%. And if necessary, you change the name on it. If the feds take it away from the children, you can't change it, or anybody, change the name on it and give it to them under a different name. So what I've tried to explain is the current history. And DSH, I want to say as a final thing, DSH has taken on a life of its own over the years. It's like it's free money or something. DSH is just a normal medical assistance payment. It happens to go into a different set of limits. It goes into its own limits the Fed has created, as opposed to normal payments go into what we call that Medicare UPL payment, upper payment limit. And the quarterly payment goes into that Medicare upper payment limit, and that's been a bone of contention with the providers. But what has happened is DSH, because it was sitting off on its own, has become, it started kind of a life of its own. And that's when all the, and then they put a limit out there. It's like a carrot out there, and everybody wants to get to maximize that limit. But they don't have state shares. So they try to create mechanisms to get at that money without having a state share. And a state share in the sense of an appropriation. These are true state shares. Everything's legal. Everything's fine and dandy. So we use GAMC as the state share, and CPE as the state share to get at that limit. We don't do that with any other medical assistance expenditure. So it's really just an MA payment handled separately on from the federal perspective. So that's about a nickel's worth.
And let me just ask a couple of questions here. First, Hennepin County puts $30-40 million of property tax subsidy into the hospital every year. Does that count, or losses accounted elsewhere?
What for a government hospital like Hennepin County Medical Center? What they contribute to the DISH payments, quarterly payments, DISH payments, what they contribute to DISH is this certified public expenditure. And that is, as I described, that is calculated. It's calculated through a Medicare cost report, very complex. The feds required this to be, they put on their cost report their uncompensated care. Tax would not go into that. What goes into it is their losses on medical assistance, including managed care medical assistance. So if we pay them 90 cents on the dollar, they would have a dime in there. And then all the people, all the GAMC people, the cost of those, if we paid them $100 for $200 with the general assistance people, they would put $200 on that cost report. So it's essentially, they're one step ahead of all the other, every single hospital, well, 110 hospitals are going to have to provide these cost reports in the next 2 years. With the feds, not us. And it's going to bother some of the little ones. Hennepin is doing this now already for purposes of the CPE. So what goes into them as subsidies, or what goes into a local hospital as subsidies from a city or county or anything, doesn't really matter. What the feds care about, we have no control over, is that all you can get out of DISH payments is up to those maximums. And that has to do with providing service.
Yeah. Are we... In terms of the stimulus package, are we going to be able to maximize our take on that?
Currently, again, I say everything is designed to maximize it. Currently, what's happening is GAMC in the forecast drops a little bit or whatever, and so you don't get quite as much out of the GAMC dish. The limits go up. The second thing is Hennepin County is currently having trouble giving us an exact number for what their CPE will be. They have a changeover in their accounting system. This is very complex stuff. I mean, and whatever the number is whatever it is. If it comes out to be $4 million or 39 cents, that's what it is. It's like doing your taxes, I guess. You can't really do them backwards. You just do them and that's what they are, you know. And so we cannot say at this exact moment that we will extinguish the entire pot of that in the quarterly payment. But that certainly is the legal requirement upon us.
And then my final one is we don't use Regents Hospital for certified public expenditures.
No. And in fact, or the university, they're both written into that statute. The University Fairview and Regents is written into that statute, 256B.199. In fact, in our technical bill, we're deleting them. The reason being is that we have had word from the feds, and this goes to a different group I work with, that Regents would not qualify any longer as a government entity meeting all these criteria, such as the ability to tax and the ability to do this and that. I'll say that over the years, this payment stuff and being able to do intergovernmental transfers and being able to do certified public expenditure stuff, the feds really cranked down on this stuff in the last 10 years. That has been quite an evolution to watch and feel, you know. So really, we don't have, at this point, we don't feel, and we have asked, and they said they would design a state plan to include Regents. We don't feel we can expand to any other hospitals. There are hospitals that would constitute government, but we wouldn't get anything out of them.
It's my understanding that the federal rules you're referring to that would keep regions out have been put in abeyance by the Congress.
Mr. Chair, yes. And that, we sent the letter over. I'm explaining that. They have told us that that is just what they were trying to promulgate as a rule. This is what they said. It's current policy. So it doesn't matter if it's under a moratorium or not. That's what they do anyway. And I think our Medicaid director sent over a letter both to Senator Berglund and yourself as authors of our bills to explain that. Mr. Chair, if it, in all honesty, and that was written originally by me as part of technical bills, and if it makes everybody feel better to leave them in, we're fine and dandy with it. It just then we'll deal with it when we have to. It has no force and effect law until we would ask for it. So that could be left in.
Well, what you said is the federal CMS people are saying that the rules that were they promulgated and are now in advance, that those rules only reflected what they were already doing?
Mr. Chair, that's what they are telling us, and that's what that letter, I believe, states.
Mr. Chairman, I can weigh in a little bit on this. Again, based on the letter that Mr. Olson referred to from our acting Medicaid director to you and Senator Berglund, that not only, because you're right, technically Regions may be a public hospital, a government unit, so even though it's under Health Partners, I don't think that actual transition may have taken place, but they also require the fact that the hospital needs to be a recipient of tax revenue, direct recipient of tax revenue, and that's not the case any longer with Regions. So we know that this is getting tighter and tighter. So it's not just being a government, a unit of government, which Regions may technically still be because of this delay in the rule, but it has to be a direct recipient of tax revenue, in this case from Ramsey County, and it's our understanding it is not. So.
Well, it's also, it's my understanding that right now, just using Hennepin County gets us the maximum we could get anyway.
Chair, that is correct, except for this. We're in a period of time right now where they cannot give us an exact number. And this stuff is all delineated in a special section of the forecast. And we've had to, they told us we had to put in zero into that section of the forecast for the CTE. So it as of the time the forecast was done, that was the information we had. Prior to that, yes, they have always brought us up to the level of the aggregate limit. But again, what happens, and we anticipate they will. But
well, it just strikes me, however, that even if Hennepin County share is enough to get the max we can get, why don't we add the Ramsey in there on top of it? Even though it won't bring us any extra money, just so the state can, in the future, look like they've been contributing a lot more.
Mr. Chair, it is getting current law. Hennepin is in there. I mean, Regions and Ramsey is in there, and the university and Fairview, although they're way out of it now. But yes, they're currently in there. And in the bill we talked with you this week about, what we call the policy bill, is there's a section in there. And if you would like to, I could point out to Randy or anybody how to leave them in and just forego this discussion. No.
I think I'm going to invite Jeff Barsh from Regents to comment. Then we'll open it up to questions. And
thank you.
And I told you, this is the most complex thing that we'll ever deal with, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh, representing Health Partners and Regents Hospital. I appreciate the opportunity to provide a few comments, particularly in response to the letter from the Department of Human Services about Regions certified public expenditures. And a little history. Up until, I have my chronological timeline here, excuse me. Up until September 2007, Regents certified public expenditures were counted by the department. It was at that time that they told us they were no longer going to be using Regents CPEs based on the federal rule that was referenced here in committee. Now, the federal rule was put out there. It was ultimately delayed, and then the Obama administration has since said goodbye to the rule. We don't believe that the decision to delay and then effectively eliminate that rule were done because of errors due to promulgation. We believe that was a direct policy decision that was made by Congress and the current administration in order to actually protect what would have been the impact to public hospitals had those rules gone into place. So we disagree with the department in terms of what the timeline of those rules has meant. They know we disagree with them on their interpretation of the rules, but I did want to make sure that that was on the record. We disagree. The other things that I'd like to mention is the letters come out, and then we've just heard that it'd be no big deal to change the bill they have before you that would remove Regents or require the department to use Regents CPEs because we wouldn't meet the definition of government hospital. Then we heard that it was because, and that's how, that CMS was always meant to do that way, which they clearly hadn't since they were recognizing Regents CPEs prior to 2007. We also heard that we wouldn't count because we don't receive direct tax dollars. Regents Hospitals does get an appropriation from Ramsey County in the last year. It was $1.4 million for uncompensated care. It is clearly just a drop in the bucket of uncompensated care that we do, but we do receive dollars from the county in order to offset some of our uncompensated care losses. So again, we believe that we would continue to qualify as a public hospital given the current rules that are in place at the federal level. I'd also just like to talk about a couple things that were mentioned here. I think the one thing that was missed in this discussion when we got through the discussion of quarterly payments is that the governor's budget takes those quarterly payments. And we heard from the department that that's $30 million that goes to the hospitals, particularly those hospitals that do the largest percentage of Medicaid business and uncompensated care. And the governor's budget eliminates those payments. Okay. Just to give you a little insight on how disproportionate of an impact elimination of those payments are, 57% of those payments go to five hospitals. Xavier University Medical Center, Hennepin County Medical Center, Regents Hospital, Children's Minneapolis, and Children's St. Paul. Okay. So you start doing the math on 57% of that loss, and you can see the impact of the department's, I should say, the administration's decision to eliminate those payments can have on the hospitals that are the safety net for our community. The reference that now DISH is a normal Medicaid payment or an MA payment, I can tell you as a hospital that relies on DISH and quarterly payments, it is not a normal payment. It's important to our business. And I think, again, we need to clarify that for the record. It's not a normal payment. This is a very important payment to those hospitals who provide care to our most needed citizens. I think that's all I have on this issue. I probably have more, but I just want to state for the record, we believe particularly at this time when it's unclear what Hennepin's numbers might look like or what our DA numbers might look like, we would hope our department would be doing everything they can to maximize federal dollars to our hospitals. And they have taken the position not to do so. And I would hope that the legislature would encourage and force them to look more strongly at utilizing the mechanisms that they have to take advantage of federal funds. I'd be happy to answer any questions. If you get more technical than what I just said, I'm not going to be able to answer them, but I will do my best.
We're obviously not going to get to the Merck today, but are there questions for Mr. Farsh?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And now we have other questions. Representative Thiessen.
Can we have Mr. Osberg come up and respond to that thing about taking the quarterly payments? Because I don't think that was clearly explained when he presented his budget last week, and that so it'd be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, sorry.
No, just the question of the quarterly payments. So you presented the budget last week, it was. We're putting $100 million into this uncompensated care pool, we're switching the GMC fee-for-service to draw down DISH dollars. And that's one of the reasons we're switching to fee-for-service. But we're also saving $119 million in this proposal or something like in that range. It's part of the reason what's happening with these DISH payments that Mr. Barsh was just referring to. Is that included in that 119, or is that additional money that's going to the bottom line?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I believe he was referring to the quarterly payments.
He was.
Which is separate from all this. And he's right, we are proposing elimination of the quarterly payments, but we are doing is maximizing the federal money. I can assure you that. And we're doing everything we can to make sure that is the case. And within what's called Medicare upper payment limit. In fact, the legislature has done a very good job of making sure we do that. So I don't understand that point that was made. Regent situation is, there's no reason why we wouldn't want to position regents for this. If we could, we would. It's simply our interpretation, our Medicaid director's interpretation talking to CMS. It's not doable. It's not possible. There's no reason why we would not do that. If we could. So it's not a policy issue, that's for sure.
Just to back up. So the switch to fee-for-service in the GAMC proposal, that is to maximize the drawdown of DISH.
That is right.
And that will make up for the fact that we don't know what Hennepin County is going to be able to... Are we going to be able to draw down, I guess my question is, just with our fee-for-service DISH and now our GAMC fee-for-service DISH?
Oh, as Mr. Olson suggested, we have those three arrangements, and we intend to maximize those three arrangements. Hopefully, Hampton County will be able to continue to work on the certification part of public expenditures, and we'll get that finalized.
Right, and Mr. Chair, I'm asking a little bit different question, and that is just if we make the change that the governor's proposing to go to more fee-for-service GAMC, which is what I understand the proposal is. Now, maybe we're going to be spending less money on that. I don't know for sure. But are those two pieces together then, kind of our typical traditional Medicaid fee-for-service and the GAMC fee-for-service, the expectation that that will get us to our state without even worrying about CPE?
The chairman represents a piece in yet.
Oh,
we'll maximize our DISH allotment.
Without referring to CPE at all.
Referring to CPE at all.
Okay, and then can you so some of this discussion about the CPE, at least for the short term, may be irrelevant because at least the governor's proposal, we already get to the maximum.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, yes.
Okay. And then the second question, just to go to this issue of eliminating the quarterly payments, can someone just explain that a little bit? I understand now from what you said that's a wholly separate issue, but it's still, I think, significant for our budget.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I'd have to go back to that budget page. But what happens there is that, as Mr. Olson suggested, before we do the quarterly payments, we take the 3 or 4%, depending on what time period we're talking about, the legislature put in place as part of financing the rate reduction a few years ago. And so what happens over time is that actually the quarterly payments go down by themselves anyway. In fact, I think I have to go back to that page, but I think in the next biennium it's much less that they would be allowed to receive in the next biennium. So we are proposing elimination of those quarterly payments going forward, and it's a little over $18 million for the 10-11 biennium, and a little less than $7 or $8 million for the biennium after that is a saving. So this actually goes down in the forecast. The quarterly payments go down by themselves anyway because of this offset that we're talking about.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and this is my last one. So, but that's $18 million that the hospitals were otherwise kind of expected to be getting in the next biennium.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, yes, they're scheduled to get that. Now, they're also, as we talked about, and I'm not going to diminish the impact of our proposals on the hospital. I've said that before. There is certainly, especially near-term, a major impact on the hospital. Now, we also have to look at the rebasing piece, which is over $370 million over the next 4 years. Increases to hospitals are in the forecast in current law, about $370 million in the next 4 years. That offsets the decreases that we're proposing. Still, I'm not suggesting in any way that there's not an impact near term. But you got to understand, the rebasing on the current law results in a $370 million increase to the hospitals over the next 4 years.
Mr. Osberg, is that based on providing the same number of services, just increased amount, or is that increased patient base, or?
Mr. Chairman, that assumes current law and current forecasts. And it does not include the ratable reduction. Remember, that's on top of it. They don't, the ratable reduction, they don't make up the ratable reduction when they rebate. They extra offsets. That still comes off that amount. What we do is that every 2 years under current law, we rebate hospital payments based on their specific cost structure. If we look at their cost structure, we have a whole herd of people having to do all this, as you heard, because of the fact that we have a very complex process of paying for hospital services. It's hospital-specific cost structure we look at. It's a lag. It's not. It's about 2 or 3 year lag as to their cost structure we look at. But using the Medicare cost reporting system, we calculate each hospital's, and so each hospital gets a different increase on that rebasing based on their cost structure.
And Representative Awer.
Well, I'll just try to ask two short questions. Can you just tell me, like, the total dish, just so I can get the whole mass of this? And then what does Hennepin County get to offset their $30 million piece out of their that certified part special for them? Just, do you know offhand?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know.
Those are supposed to be easy.
How much Hennepin County gets? You mean Hennepin County Medical Center gets in terms of all the dish money? Or
well, just offset that certified, that they kick in $30, $40 million. Well, how much is offset because of that in the certified public expenditures part that they get?
Mr. Chair, Representative Averill, we can get to you all payments under the quarterly payment, if you want, and the dish payments to each hospital. I don't know offhand what Hennepin County Medical Center would be. Our current...
what's the global... How much do you pay out in dish altogether, just to help us understand that?
The state fiscal year 09, Representative Abler, federal limit is $75 million times 2 for MA, because of the state share, it's $150
million. Thank you.
Okay, and Representative Murphy. Last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Broad has one, too.
Mine is just an information request. If we're going to get the data from the department, it would be helpful to know when expenditures that have resulted from Medicaidizing, that word, but the funds, if we could figure out where that has been spent outside of hospital reimbursement, I would like that information, too. Thank you.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, can we ask for clarification on that? What do you mean outside, yes, Representative Murphy, outside of hospitals? We don't, it's not used for outside of hospitals.
Mr. Chair, the quarterly payments, I think, are dish payments, and they've been used for other things. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
I'll talk with the Commissioner when we're done.
Okay. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question and then a request for information as well. The question is to Mr. Osberg. I'm wondering, can you help me understand better why that $1.4 million transfer from Ramsey County doesn't count for the purposes of CMS consideration for CQE for that hospital?
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Broad, we'll have to take a look at that. I'm not aware of that. And I'll have to talk to the Medicaid director as well as Mr. Olson's staff about that very situation. I assume we've taken that consideration. I don't know any more than that.
Okay,
we'll find that out.
And then my last request for information is just, I don't know if Mr. Olson can show me or point out where I might understand better how the federal government related to the dish payments, you know, it's kind of mind-boggling on how they actually come to not just the state fair, but how they appropriate the money to the various states. So what I'm trying to figure out is, are states that are generous in certain ways able to draw down more money, or are states who are lax in their responsibility able to draw down more money in terms of the dish payments? Or if there's no correlation.
Originally, when the state limits were put on. They were based upon what the state had been spending. In fact, we went with a lawsuit with Wyoming because they grabbed some information from us that hadn't been finalized and was extremely low. So there are states that are called high dish states and states that are called low dish states. And of course, as usual, the high dish get grandfathered to a certain extent and the low dish don't. These are, we can give you the numbers and we can send over the federal registers. They put out federal register lists every state. And in fact, they've got so strict on this that for mental health, IMDs, those type of things like our state facilities, they have a separate limit, and that's only $2.6 million federal share for us. And they're controlling, that was to stop the states from building their RTCs out of cash.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Mr. Olson, I'm just wondering, which one do we fall into then if you separate them as high and low?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we are very, very low. Never did this.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Olson, is it fair to say that once again Minnesota is punished for doing things efficiently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rod, that would be... We are trended from the past, if that's a punishment.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rod, yes, your question is yes. As usual, we have been disadvantaged for the federal government in health care, Medicare especially.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I think I'm starting to understand it now. So with that, the meeting is adjourned.